in thinking about what it is to be a person, and thinking about what that means, what that commitment might mean to educators, I think we need to think about four kinds of issues. And in thinking about what it is to prepare for adult life, one way of framing it is, I think, around the development of four sets of capacities. The first one is about framing the good, developing a sense of self and what's valuable to you, what kind of life you want to lead, what kind of person you want to be. It's also about developing the capacities that allow you to pursue the kind of conception of a good life you have and changes that you might, the revisions that you might make in that conception of a good life. So it's about developing the capacities that allow you to successfully pursue in the current institutional environment of workplaces, labour markets, communities, the state, to pursue the kinds of life that you think valuable. It also means that you need to be able to protect the kind of life or your interests that you have formed for yourself and that you pursue. And we normally, in a liberal democracy, we do that through liberal democratic political processes. You need to be able to represent and protect your interests in the political arena. That's a huge task of education in a politically informed view of a liberal democratic education. And then finally, education needs to be about developing those capacities to protect protection. Because liberal democratic institutions, the universal franchise, periodic elections, competitive parties, free press, the rule of law, are essentially about allow people to pursue their own good and to have that good represented in parliament or in decision-making bodies. The principle of political equality is the equal representation and consideration of interests. That's what the protecting the good is about. But the fourth one is about protecting the institutions that make protection possible. So it's about protecting, engaging in activities that protect the rule of law, that support through various ways parliamentary government, liberal democracy, tolerance, and so those principles that define a liberal democracy. So a liberal democratic education is one that attends to all four of these principles and not just one or two. Now, let me say a few words about framing the good. What does it mean? This is a question that has exercised philosophers and theologians from both from within the Christian Judeo-Christian tradition as well as Greek philosophy. We can see that, for example, in the book of Genesis, the whole issue about the tree of knowledge was the tree of knowledge was the fruit of good and evil. That was the key issue on which Adam and Eve had to wrestle with at that moment. And then in Greek moral philosophy, of course, there are two questions that they established as the core of the Western moral tradition, philosophical tradition. One was, what is the good? What does it mean to have a good life? What does a good life consist of? Not the good life, but a good life. And secondly, what is the right thing to do? What is justice? And those are the two questions that have dominated Western moral philosophy over the last two and a half millennia. So what is it to talk about our notions of a good life? And what I want to argue is that those notions of good, and this, I'm going to follow Charles Taylor in this, are central to our notions of self and central to the process of what education is about. It's absolutely critical, intimately connected to what life, deciding what kind of a life is worthwhile and valuable, finding who you are and what's important to you is a core part of what the educational process is about. It's not simply about allocating people into the labour market or preparing them for a particular lifetime occupation. So where do we go from here? This is Charles Taylor, author of a book that I constantly find myself going back to called Sources of the Self. It's a history of Western moral philosophy from the Greeks onwards in many ways, with a particular focus on the last 300-400 years. What Taylor argues is that notions of the good, forming a notion of the good, is a central part of who we are, of self-definition, of defining the self. In fact, it's impossible to have a sense of who we are without at the same time having a sense of what is valuable to us. What is valuable to us helps constitute our identity, our sense of self, our sense of place, our narrative, our biography that we create over time. And in this book, he sort of unravels this issue again and again and again. How important it is to have a coherent sense of good in order for us to have a coherent sense of self. And that this is an unfolding story. It's a story that we talk to ourselves every day about what's valuable to me, and it becomes a part of the narrative of the self that we develop over time. Okay, given that framework, given that broad philosophical framework, what do young people in Australia want? And I'm going to offer some data. I don't have data from Australia to talk about, but I'm going to talk about some data from Singapore. I have similar or comparable data in some ways from Tasmania that I collected about 4 years ago. But it's not quite comparable, and it doesn't quite do the work that I want this table to do. So I'm going to report on some results. This is a survey of 10,000 year, the equivalent to a year 11 students in Singapore. It was a representative sample, and we asked them to assess, to indicate how important some 32, 33 items were in their lives. And this is a rank ordering of their aspirations, what it is that defines their good. Now, you can see, and in Singapore, as in most Asian countries, there's a strong sense upon that a key moral value and aspiration is about taking care of the parents. That's beginning to weaken now, and there's a great deal of policy debate in Singapore, for example, about this issue. It's called filial piety. Now, when I talk about these results in Singapore, the audience, if they're older, always feel immensely relieved at the first finding, taking care of your parents, particularly because the social security system there is not as extensive as it is here. But I've highlighted a number of items: to respect myself, to have a sense of meaning and purpose in life, to have a sense of achievement, to make my own choices, to figure out who I am, to set my own goals. You'll notice that I've highlighted these, and that also of the top 11, six of them configure or co-vary around what we in analysis described as a set of existential aspirations. What's important? And if you go through the list, all the way through from all of those existential aspirations to educational aspirations, to work aspirations, to family aspirations, to religious aspirations, all the way down to eating at expensive restaurants. This came as a shock to people in Singapore, because Singaporeans tend to self-define themselves as compulsive shoppers. So those of you who've been to Singapore and walked down Orchard Road, you'll understand why. But to my amazement, and to the amazement of everybody else, this group of Year 11 students said, no, it's not really important at all. We do it, but it's not central to how we define ourselves and our futures. So we did some factor analysis, and not only did we find that those aspirations were, those existential aspirations that I've listed here, were the highest mean scores, we also found that the pattern of covariance was the most coherent. It was by far and away the strongest set of single factor in the range of factors that we found across the 32 or 33 items. So it had among the highest mean scores, and it had the least covariance. It was a very powerful scale. So we call the existential aspiration scale. The alpha is a measure of the degree of covariance. Anything over 0.7 is considered very good. Anything over 0.9 is, over the moon. So it's a very, very strong, coherent scale. We also found that, and this surprised us immensely, we also found that these aspirations did not vary in any statistically significant way by social class, by gender, by race, by primary school attainment, secondary school experience, or secondary school attainment. At the end of primary six, kids do the PSLE in Singapore, which allocates them into secondary school streams. At the end of secondary school, they do the O-levels, and that allocates them into the post-secondary institutions. Now, we found that there were no differences. We thought there'd be significant class differences, even race differences. None. no differences at all that were statistically significant. So broadly speaking, those aspirations here are shared by kids from every social background. Now, I don't know, we don't have data, I have similar data from Australia that's only partial. And what I do know is that we've got similar results. I didn't use the Australian data because it's not as comprehensive. But we have similar result data from Tasmania from 2002. So I think this gives us a sense of what it is that matters to young people in a very fundamental sense about what defines a good life. I also did some statistical analysis on the relationship between these issues to test some of Taylor's arguments out, and found that his philosophical argument, in fact, can be supported empirically by the character of the relationships between these items. Okay. Framing the good in postmodernity or high modernity or the contemporary period, of course, is no easy task, and has been made complicated by a number of key institutional developments. And I'm just going to talk about two of them that have preoccupied contemporary sociologists of modernity. One is broadly called deinstitutionalization or detraditionalization or desocialization, and the other is called compulsory individualization. And both of these issues have immensely complicated the process by which young people engage in the process of forming a vision of the self, a sense of a good life, a sense of self even. And I'm going to just kind of briefly talk about these two. The first is the process of deinstitutionalization. Now, by this, sociologists of modernity mean that over the last 20, 30, 40 years, there's been a progressive decoupling of individuals from traditional institutions, from values, from norms, from identities, from attachments. And so you get this progressive separation of individuals, individual selves, from traditional social supports or social structures, whether they be families, class, communities, whatever. So you get this kind of progressive deinstitutionalization of individual lives. And that's resulted in the fact that as kids begin to form a conception of what a good life would be for them, what it would mean, what does it mean to have a life that's valuable and rewarding to themselves, they are progressively required, indeed the term is often used to talk about compulsory individualization, are progressively required to rely on their own resources, their own judgments, their own understandings, in order to do that, and progressively less on traditional values or norms or attachments. Now, that creates a great deal of anxiety among parents and social commentators, because people worry the kids are deracinated, they're alienated, they don't have a clear sense of direction or sense of what a life is about. And that's reflected in the various constructions of the self in modernity that sociologists and psychologists have prepared. And we can see some of these here. I've listed some of these you'd be familiar with. The one that I'm going to just talk about is a quote from Kevin MacDonald, who's a sociologist in Melbourne, University of Melbourne, who did a study of Western Melbourne in the late 90s. And it's a study of a group of Vietnamese, Cambodian and Aboriginal kids, late adolescents. The book is called Struggle for Subjectivity, and it's an amazing kind of story, powerful story, about how these kids were struggling to understand their social experiences in communities with high unemployment, with high drug use, high family breakdown. How did they understand? How did they frame their experience? And they couldn't do it. They just didn't have the intellectual resources to be able to frame and understand their own personal and social experiences. And what Kevin MacDonald is doing here is talking about this as that these life worlds of these kids are progressively disorganized in terms of their access to kind of coherent social norms, roles, and transmitted patterns of socialization. So we get here a really good example of this process of deinstitutionalization and the impact it's having on the individual life course and of the framing of the good. That poses, I think, a huge challenge for education. Indeed, I think in many ways, it's the fundamental moral challenge that educators have to deal with, have to confront. And it means that if we think about education in narrowly instrumental terms as preparation for the labour market, for example, I think we're doing young people an injustice. our obligation as educators, as teachers, is to help young people frame and develop the capacities to lead a life that's useful, rewarding, and valuable to themselves and their communities. But the current organisation, our institutional arrangements, make that progressively more difficult and complex. So that, I think, ups the ante for educators, and it means that we have to attend to that issue all the way to school, from kindergarten all the way through to year 12. So these are some of the issues then that we have to address. Now, I think framing a good as a process is not about studying the canonical texts. That's a useful thing to do, but it's not sufficient. It's about having a broad experience of life and of different ways of life. Amy Gutman talks about this as the principle of non-repression, that young people need to have access, both in theory and in practice, to different ways of life. What it is to be a carpenter, what it is to be a lawyer, what it is to think about to quantum physics, or to read an epic poem like Paradise Lost. So these are all issues that need to be taken into account in thinking about what it is to frame a good life. Howard Gardner, who's a well-known educational commentator, a professor at Harvard, one of the leading cognitive scientists of the last half century, wrote a book about 7 years ago called The Disciplined Mind, in which he said that there are three fundamental issues that education has to deal with. One is the realm of truth, the second is the realm of beauty, and the third is the area of the realm of morality. And that education is fundamentally concerned about developing an understanding of the broader themes of life, indeed with the question of why the world as it is and how life can and should be lived. And that's partly what, and in good part, what education is about. Preparing for the labour market, preparing for an occupational future is a part of that, but it's not the whole story. Okay. The third principle, design principle that I want to point to is one that is intellectually rich, coherent and rich. Now this is fairly straightforward and I'm not going to spend as much time on this issue as I have on the two previous ones. It has to have depth, it has to have breadth, it has to have connectivity. That is, kids need to understand the relationships of different kinds of knowledges, both theoretical and practical, to each other. And I'll talk more about that later. And it needs to cultivate understanding. And by that, I want to focus on conceptual understanding, because that's the key for understanding relationships in the world, to have concepts that give you a way of capturing process of what happens in the world and what's happening to your own life. It's about epistemic and cognitive agency. It's about application, about problem solving, about concept building, about interpretation, about explanation. It's not just about memorization. It's about meaning making. Jerome Bruner, in a really fascinating and whimsical book that he wrote 15 years ago, talked about his aspirations at the very beginning of the cognitive revolution in the 1950s. He was one of the founding fathers of cognitive science in America. And he said when they started out the cognitive revolution, what they had in mind was a focus on meaning making. And what they got was a focus on information processing. That's the fundament, for all, the first principle of justice. And secondly, it has to be consistent with democratic social reproduction. That is, it has to be consistent with liberal democratic principles that we can govern ourselves and we need to have institutions that allow us to govern ourselves. So, this is John Rawls before he died. And then I want to turn to some curriculum design principles, and particularly the principle of disciplinarity and transdisciplinarity. Now, I know Peter has, and I believe Rob Gilbert as well, talked about this in their presentation, so I'm not going to say much about transdisciplinarity other than to sort of flag its importance. I want to focus on disciplinarity. And I want to draw a distinction between academic subjects and disciplines. Now, they're not the same. They are different. They have a very intimate relationship. They have a long historical relationship. But academic subjects, the kinds of things that get taught in schools, whether it be history or maths or woodwork, vary immensely in the degree of disciplinarity that are embedded in the organisation of the knowledge that's transmitted in the curriculum. And it's reflected as well in variations in the degree of disciplinarity of curriculum units and in teacher capacities. Teachers vary in the degree of understanding that they have of the disciplinarity of the subject matter.